Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Big Chief with a badge, a cattle prod, and a head on a stick.
Dangerous mid-morning debate with the Great Dictator.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. It's a funny old world, isn't it, out there in the land of Brexit? It seems the Prime Minister's chief negotiator in Europe let slip in a bar last night that no deal is officially off the table, while at the same time threatening that the whole process could be delayed for years if a deal cannot be agreed. Then we have the rather ludicrous spectacle of the head of MI6 claiming that he needs to stay on beyond Brexit to make sure everything runs smoothly. Call me old-fashioned, but I thought MI6 was supposed to be a secretive, shadowy-type organisation. How do we even know who's in charge of it? And why is he telling everyone what he's going to do? His name is C, by the way. We'll be giving you his full name and address later on. Most importantly this morning, on the Brexit front, though, the worm has officially turned. Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, who has switched sides and is now backing Leave. After dozens of speeches warning about the dangers of leaving the European Union, of all sorts of economic carnage, of depression-type stuff coming through, a lot worse than the 1930s, being chief cheerleader in charge of Remain, Carney has now decided that Brexit could usher in his words, a golden age of international cooperation and cross-border commerce. I can't wait to hear all the Remain fanatics quoting him ad nauseam. 0344 499 1000. Coming up a little bit later on, I'll be asking just why George Clooney is such an idiot. I'll also be asking why prisoners are deliberately re-offending just to get a roof over their heads, and why so many people actually believe the sell-by dates on the food that they buy. 0344 499 1000. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Oh, my old man's a dustman, he wears a dustman's hat. He wears gold blimey trousers and he lives in the council flat. He looks a proper nana in his great big gobnail boots. He's got such a job to pull them up, but he calls them Daisy Roots.
Now, as much as you may think that Brexit is the overarching reason why we do talk radio and why we have phone-in programmes, it's not. There was a time before Brexit when we used to talk about all sorts of things. And one of the things I used to talk about an awful lot, regardless of whether I was in Edinburgh, regardless of whether I was in London, no matter where I was in the world, was rubbish, OK? Now, there are those of you who will think that, of course, I talk rubbish because that's what I talk all the time. But that would be unfair and unkind. What I'm saying is that everyone has a story about rubbish. Everyone has a story about garbage. Everybody's unhappy, generally speaking, with the way that their rubbish is taken away. We throw away an awful lot of stuff in this world in which we live. And unfortunately, it's a very, very difficult job to take it all away. There's now a story saying that almost 5,000 complaints were made about missed bin collections received by councils every single day last year. So we're in a problem here. We have got a sort of crisis, a crisis of rubbish. Let's talk to Councillor Peter Fleming, who's chair of the LGA's Improvement and Innovations Board. That's a local government association. Peter, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Morning, Mike. I was just thinking we should re-record that song, My Old Man's a Waste Operative.
Well, indeed, or in fact, not even my old man, but somebody who is very close to me and could be related in my family, because you don't want to make it that it's just a job for
absolutely.
Men, obviously. Now, we got a problem here, haven't we? Because there's so much rubbish in the world, so much rubbish in this country. You know, where are you going to put it all? Who's going to take it all away?
Well, absolutely. I mean, obviously, the headline of the report is you know, 1 million missed collections. But actually, you know, that's out of 821 million waste collections from households every year. And that doesn't include recycling collections.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, actually, yes, we've seen an increase, but actually there's just more rubbish out there.
Well, there is. And I mean, the problem is, for you guys, it can't be getting any cheaper because nothing's getting any cheaper. And it's getting more segmented. And people are probably getting better educated about what to do with their rubbish. But, you know, there's always going to be a problem, isn't there?
Well, look, the government only about a week, maybe 2 weeks ago, came out with their new waste strategy, which would actually mean that councils would have to be spending way more money collecting rubbish, because we'd have to be collecting, you know, batteries separately, you know, cans separately, glass, you know, loads of stuff separately, which would add huge amounts of cost to, you know, what is already, for a lot of councils, one of their most costly services they provide to the whole public. And it is that universal service. Everybody benefits from rubbish and recycling collection.
I mean, if you were to ask most people in this country, what do you want your local council to do? They would probably put bin collection up as number one or two, because that's what they think of it, of you guys doing. And we know that you do a lot more than that. But when you see councils changing over from a weekly collection to a fortnightly collection, there's a couple of councils in this report who apparently have gone to a monthly collection. I mean, that's just not good enough, particularly in the summer.
Well, look, I mean, people, you're absolutely right. It's the most visible service that councils provide. And actually, it's one of the few absolutely universal services councils provide as well. So something that everybody sees, everybody uses. So, but the reality is that actually 8 out of 10 people are happy about their waste collection services. And when you look at the number of complaints about miscollections, when you look at the totality of all the collections we make, it's a tiny fraction. So, councils take it incredibly seriously. Rubbish collection is, you know, that most visible service. And all councils, I don't know a council in the country that doesn't take waste collection seriously. So, you know, we are focused on it, but it's in that, you know, that whole world. And I'm sure you've covered this as well, Mike. By next year, councils will have lost 60p in every pound of their funding. And, you know, that is going to have an impact on the services we provide to residents.
I mean, most of the councils that I'm aware of, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, have outsourced their bin collecting anyway, haven't they? Not certainly in all of the places I see around London and even in Sussex, where I also live. They're all different companies. They're not the actual local council doing the collecting.
Well, look, I mean, I could bore you about the 1980s and compulsory competitive tendering, but I won't bore you. I mean, my own authority, which is Sevenoaks District Council, we still have it in house. We still collect rubbish and recycling every week, you know, because it is that most visible of services. Other councils, you know, they've outsourced to companies, but they work with those companies to make sure, you know, that they're providing the best quality service that they can, but also, you know, keeping an eye on those costs to the hard-working council taxpayer. It's becoming increasingly difficult, though, as we're seeing government funding for local services massively reduce over the last 10 years. Huge reduction.
Sure. But how is it possible, say, for you guys in Sevenoaks to maintain the service and keep it in-house, which is obviously better, in my view, because you've got better control over it, and other people can't do that?
Well, look, I think there's some history there going all the way back to the 80s. So the in-house team, before my time, won that compulsory competitive tendering tender, and obviously from that point on it was in-house. Obviously once you outsource, you've got to, if you want to bring it back in, there are huge costs of, you know, buying the vehicles, you know, bringing those people, the staff back into the council. And, you know, it's a local choice. You know, they've made a choice around, you know, how they want to provide services. And some of it is finance driven. Some of it is because actually those companies can do things that, you know, the council in that particular situation don't believe that they can do. And there might be some economies of scale, or, you know, their neighbouring councils can work together. It's about local choice. I mean, the key word when it comes to local government is local. It should be about, you know, that local decision making and local services for local people. And you know, this idea that we should have some sort of nationalised waste collection and recycling, you know, thing, just not going to work. The only people that have got two homes and have to worry about two different collection things are blinking MPs.
And well, I mean, you might say that, but that would be entirely incorrect. And I'm not going to tar them all with the same brush. But what about this, Peter? What's the future? Because in the end, we'll be producing more rubbish. You'll be probably asking us to separate it out even more than we already do. But you're going to have to put it somewhere. You're going to have to find a new way of getting rid of it, aren't you?
Well, absolutely. And again, you know, we have to have those conversations with the public as well. I mean, clearly there's been a massive push to reduce landfill and, you know, lots and lots of reports about that. There's huge amounts of cost involved in putting rubbish in the ground. And actually, I don't think anybody truly believes that that is the way that we should go. But, you know, in some cases, that's the only option at the moment. We have the ability to turn waste to energy. But actually, what we need to do as a society, and this is not just down to local councils, but, you know, down to manufacturers, all of us, is to be producing less rubbish. Mm. If we can reduce the amount of packaging, if we can reduce the amount of stuff, then actually we save ourselves money through council tax and the amount of money councils have to pay on collecting and dealing with that rubbish. But actually, we're also helping the environment as well. So I think there's a big push to reduce the amount of stuff that we're actually putting out in our bins or our bags every week.
And what about this question finally from Scott, who's tweeted in? He says, can you please ask Peter if they actually do keep bins separate? As my missus is paranoid about it, I get told off every day for putting things in the wrong bins. I think that's more of an issue with his marriage than it is about the bins, to be fair. But do you actually? Because I've seen bottle banks, right, which have got brown, clear and green entrances, right, picked up by a massive sort of, you know, skip truck and all dumped into the same place. So I don't know why they bothered separating them in the first place.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, glass is a real. It's an interesting case study, but basically, the recycling is a marketplace, and that marketplace, there are peaks and troughs. Sometimes those people that take the glass.
Yep. Peter's disappeared. See if we
really have a value. Any of them have a value. So actually, you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to keep the public going with recycling whilst also maintaining a relationship with the marketplace, which is where the recycling goes afterwards. And if there is no marketplace for a recycler at a particular time, then actually that makes it even harder for councils to deal with waste.
Okay, Peter, thank you very much indeed. Councillor Peter Fleming there from Sevenoaks, Chair of the LGA's Improvement and Innovations Board. Got a great tweet here, though, from Luke, who says, here you go, Mike, I live in Blaenau Gwent, highest council tax in Wales, spent millions on a recycling trolley scheme. Then the council comes out and says the recycling percentage is too low, 3-week black bag collections with a maximum of 4 black bags only. Absolutely shocking. And he's got the Blaenau Gwent average Band D council tax running at £1,827. That's extraordinary. Absolutely ridiculous, isn't it? It really is. It's so unfair in all different parts of the country, and it works differently in different parts of the country. Surely they need to get a grip of it.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
From the Farmer of Fury,
the Independent Republic of Mike Graham
on Talk Radio.
Try
This is the Independent Republican, Mike Graham. 0344 499 1000 is the number. We're going to go to the phones very, very shortly. Prime Minister's questions is going on. The guy from the SNP is now standing up and trying to get some reassurances. I don't know why he bothers, really. Nobody pays much attention to him at the best of times. And certainly got nothing to say about Brexit. But apparently the SNP are going to be putting in some form of an amendment tomorrow in which they're going to try and challenge the whole idea of Brexit and try and get it all called off. Well, that's not going to happen either, I'm sorry to say. 0344 499 1000. Craig is in Oxford. Hi, Craig.
Afternoon, mate.
Afternoon. What do you want to tell us?
Well, I was going to talk about video games, but just first, I thought I'd throw in that when we go shopping, we buy between 14 and 12 and 16 pints of milk at a time.
Really?
And it never goes off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you must drink a lot of milk, is all I can say.
Yeah, yeah. But in terms of video games, I'd argue that actually I think they're beneficial, even violent ones. Any video game or any computer game is brilliant at dexterity and, you know, reflexes and brain drain. So it keeps you quite alert and quite reactive.
Not if you stay up all night doing it and you don't sleep.
No. Obviously, if you take things to extreme, and nothing's good for you.
Right.
But in, you know, a certain amount, you know, hour a day, hour every other day, something like that is fine.
Right.
And actually, a lot of teenagers with pent-up angst and anger, you know, venting a little bit of violence on the video game where it doesn't hurt anyone probably isn't the worst thing at all. It's probably a bit of therapy.
Yeah, maybe. You know, so, I mean, I suppose the point is, Craig, like many of these things, other, you know, certain people are affected differently than other people. You know, I mean, exactly. Some people can get behind the wheel of a car and drive in a sensible manner. Other people can learn how to drive in a sensible manner and suddenly turn into maniacs as soon as they get on out on the road on their own.
Exactly. You know, 10 years ago, it was rap music that was the cause of all violence and anger in you know, teenagers.
Yeah.
That was video games. It's been movies. I'm sure it'll be social media next that gets the blame for it.
I mean, I took my kids to a place in Surrey the other week, the other weekend, for a sort of driving lesson, effectively, off-road, you know. Yeah. And because they played these driving games, video games, they actually were pretty good at it already. You know, and the guy who was the teacher said to them, have you ever driven anything? And I said, well, not really. I've driven a couple of go-karts and stuff. But he said, have you ever driven any driving video games? And they said, yeah. And he said, well, that'll help you. You know, and they kind of knew intrinsically what to do.
I believe I'm right. I remember seeing somewhere that I think it's over in Japan. A lot of the surgeons that do the robotic surgery play video games and do things like that as practice. I think it's got its role, and you know, but people are just so quick to blame stuff.
It's, right.
You know, it was just
The RAF have said in the past that they quite like kids who are good at video games because they can train them to be pilots because they've got the same kinds of skills.
Exactly. You think about lots of different things at once. You've got to press loads of different controls and buttons and sequences. It's brilliant for the modern world.
Yeah, it'll come as no surprise to you that I'm hopeless at them, of course. I mean, I've pretty much stopped playing at Space Invaders. That was what I was good at.
Well, there's always time for reform, isn't there? So.
Well, no, I'm never playing my kids at anything. They'd beat me, and I would be, you know, inconsolable. Craig, thanks very much indeed. Let's talk to Mark, who's in High Wycombe. Hello, Mark.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon. Very well, sir. What would you like to say?
Just listening to your show, Mike, always a great show. You know, the more news outlets that I listen to, programmes like yours, is it just me or is the Remain argument losing its way?
I think it totally is. I think they're grasping at straws, you know, massively now.
You know, it just comes across more and more, Mike. And, you know, those of us, and I hold my hands up, I voted for Brexit. And, you know, I've taken quite a barracking off of certain quarters for doing so. I still believe that what I voted for is a good way forward for this country. But you're branded almost like a nationalist.
Yeah.
Aren't those who want to remain in the EU protectionists?
Well, there's a bit of snobbery going on here as well, I think, Mark. And people like to think of themselves as Remainers as kind of slightly more intellectually superior. I don't know why they think that, but I don't know why they think that.
Well, people like me apparently were thick and we didn't know what we were voting for.
Right. But you see these people trotting, they trot out these statistics like, well, most university-educated people voted to remain. Well, so what? It means nothing to me.
Well, the other thing is as well, Mike, I mean, you know, I've been around, I'm nearly 50 years of age. For as long as I can remember, people have always been moaning about the economy,
right.
The NHS, this what was so great about the status quo before even the idea of a referendum a few years ago?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I say this to people all the time, Mark. I don't remember anybody ever coming up to me when I was walking the streets or when I was doing radio shows, ringing up to say, by the way, isn't it great that we're in the European Union? Nobody ever said that.
Yeah, and now that we're trying to do something to better the prospects of this country, suddenly that's wrong.
Yeah, I know.
It's bonkers.
And do you find your friends are kind of shunning you now, or your members of your family are shunning you now?
Well, I think maybe shunning's a little bit strong, but I mean, certainly, you know, there's been disagreements.
Mm.
And I think people are actually scared of treading into a different direction because it's almost like better the devil you know.
Yeah. It's a very odd psychology that has kind of taken over those people who lost the referendum. They don't seem capable of accepting the fact that they've lost it. I don't understand.
You're so right.
You know?
You're so right. It's almost like, you know, the result, I don't think it'll ever be accepted in some quarters.
And I think that'll be very a sad day for our country if the people who lost the referendum cannot accept it, and when we do leave, they don't just shut up, because that's what they should do.
Well, the other thing is, Mike, you know, I mean, I was much younger in, I guess, what was it, 1975, when this country went into the...
Yeah, well, 73 was the vote, yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, did we sign up to all of what we're doing now back then?
Of course not. Absolutely not.
How did we get dragged into it?
Well, I mean, there was a thing called the Lisbon Treaty, which, funnily enough, came up this week because we saw Jeremy Corbyn at the time making a speech saying how awful the European Union was and how we had to get out of it and how we had to beat it. You know, now he's kind of doing his best to make out that, you know, he wants to stay in it, but he'll go along with leaving it because that's what the people voted for. So, yes, I mean, the Lisbon Treaty kind of enacted a lot of the stuff that we're now bought into, but we never bought into places like Croatia and Romania and Bulgaria and the Czech Republic becoming part of the European Union at all.
Mike, you know what? One of the best ideas I've heard lately, and there's been so much madness talked about, if people want another referendum, what about after we've left, give it 2 or 5 years and then ask the people, do you want to stay outside?
Yes.
Or
that's
do you want to rejoin
fine.
The European Union?
As I say to these Remainer MPs, you can't just have another referendum before you've enacted the first one. You've got to enact the first one, then, after a period of time, like you suggest, have another one if you want.
Absolutely.
Makes perfect sense, Mark. Thank you very much indeed. Let's talk to Richard quickly. Richard's in Lee. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Mike.
Hi, very well indeed. What do you want to say?
Yeah, I was listening to you guys from Seven Oaks Council, you know, talking about the bin collection and all that sort of thing. And it just makes my blood boil a bit, because if I talk about my own council, which is Wigan Council, I mean, Seven Oaks will have to speak for itself, but last year they did all the bin collection changes and they saved something like £2 million in doing the process, and you think, yeah, save £2 million, that's good. But in the same year, they managed to hoard £35 million of taxpayers' money without spending it on anything. They just added it to the usable reserves. Now that actually increased the reserve. They already had £148 million in the bank,
and they're always moaning they haven't got any money, aren't they?
Well, that's what makes me angry. It's all our money, whether it comes from government or the council or whatever. But they're saying that the government isn't giving them enough money and all that. And I'm thinking, well, could you just sort of raid your own bank account first before you start asking us for more money? Because now, I mean, Wigan Council and other councils are the same. They've got now usable reserves of £177 million whilst they're closing libraries and cutting out bin collections and all the rest of it. Now, I'm all for a rainy day fund. You know, everybody needs to have a bit put by. And you know, if you talk about a council, that'll be a few million pounds. But £177 million whilst we're not getting our bins collected, that's not rainy day. That's a virtual everyday monsoon fund.
Well, it is.
When you're cutting bin collections and when you're doing all these things and cutting services and what have you, you know, to me that's raining. You know, so what does it have to do to actually raid some of the reserves that you've already got? You know, you've already taken this money off the people.
No, it's a very good point. It's a very good point, Richard. I'll tell you what. Next time we get some councillor on, I'll ask them why they do that. Thank you very much indeed for that information, Richard in Lee. There saying that the problem here is that the councils are stockpiling money. That's what they're doing, and it's our money, and they shouldn't be doing it. Let's talk now, though, to somebody who is an expert. She is, of course, Dr. Linda Papadopoulos, psychologist and host of the Psychology Behind Pod. Now, she may not be an expert on Brexit, but she's certainly an expert on life. Dr. Linda, very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. So it says here in front of me that basically you are at your happiest age 16 and 70, which I can fundamentally disagree with.
Are you feeling happy?
I'm very happy.
Good for you.
And
good.
I'm neither of those ages, I'm happy to say.
I think there's always really interesting stuff that comes out with kind of age-related happiness. And I think what tends to happen is there's this sort of lull during middle age, right? So around when you're in your kind of 40s and 50s.
Right.
And I think that's for a lot of reasons, right? I think at that time in life, you're kind of this sandwich between sort of caring for children that are reaching adulthood and then...
Yeah.
Caring for parents that are older. I think there's a lot of people kind of get down at that time because there's a lot of taking stock of life, right? So it's not like when you are sort of in your teens and the whole world's ahead of you, it's a time of thinking, where have I come? Where do I have to go? What do I have to look forward to? But interestingly enough, as people get older, we do in fact see that things settle down and
yeah.
That happiness peaks. And I think a lot of that is perspective. A lot of the social status, the materialism that you kind of buy into as an adult, that, you know, did I manage to get the right title, the right postcode, the right whatever it is that, you know, you feel. I think you see through the emperor's clothes as you get older, or hopefully you do, which is why we kind of see again this sort of rise in sort of the autumn years of life, shall we say.
No, quite. I mean, we're always hearing at the moment how unhappy teenagers are. So how do they come up with this figure of 16 being a happy age? Because supposedly teenagers now are terribly confused, they're terribly mixed up, they don't know what to do, they don't know where to go, they can't get a job, they don't know what house to buy, they haven't got any money. You know, I mean, how do they work this out?
I have no idea. I haven't seen how they came up. I don't know if it was like a self-report questionnaire. I don't know if it was around a specific area. What I do know, again, if it is about kind of hopefulness about the future, if that's what they were asking about, oftentimes that is higher around sort of the teen years just because...
Right.
Prospects. I'm sure if they had been asking about stress, they would have gotten a very different answer.
Well, they're asking
people.
Apparently, they say here that the survey was carried out by the Office of National Statistics. Respondents rated their life satisfaction, self-worth, happiness and anxiety from 1 to 10. So, you know, maybe they're just more happy than everybody else is really miserable.
Well, there you go. Maybe it's about a comparative thing. Look, I think, again, there is something about in this new day and age, I think sometimes happiness being relative to others, and we speak a lot about social media for young people and kind of in comparison to others' lives, never feeling they're as good as. So I wonder again, in the way the questions were asked weren't in comparison to others, what there was something around satisfaction in the here and now, which maybe, you know, is what's happening there.
Yeah, I mean, I often wonder when people talk about their happiness sort of levels in life, that they're just not prepared for the different stages of life. Because you can say that in your 30s and 40s, when you're having younger children and the children are growing up, it's quite stressful, you know, managing everything, but it's part of what you choose to do, surely. I mean, if you didn't want to have kids, you shouldn't have had them.
Well, absolutely. I my pet peeve is that we kind of speak about happiness as this state that you reach and you're like, okay, I'm there now, and not, it's captured in a moment. And actually, in the same way, I think we shouldn't kind of aspire to, like, happiness, you know, being something we feel 24/7. I think
right.
We should also kind of, you know, embrace problems. You know, I always say to the people I work with, I say this to my daughter, that it's, you know, it's like a I don't know, a Rubik's Cube or a puzzle life. You know, you solve one problem and you move on to the next and you approach it in that problem-solving way. And then in between, you do have those wonderful parties or sunsets or lunches with, you know, great friends.
Yeah.
Or, you know, winning games, and you savor those. But the idea that we have to be happy all the time, or that life should be an unending array of happiness, I think is kind of a really pressurizing, frankly, toxic idea. You know, it's captured in a moment, like perfection.
Yeah, and I wonder whether, if we are to believe the stories about sort of anxiety that teenagers face, it's because they're under pressure to be happy. You know, now this is not going to help it, is it? Because they're going to be reading this study and going, blimey,
no,
I'm 16, it's supposed to be about as happy as I ever get.
Till I'm 70 to be happy again. Yeah, no, I think, you know, there really is something about the way we speak about happiness. I couldn't agree with more. And the way that we speak speak about difficulties, right? You know, the words, the language that we use, whether we see ourselves as being victim to these things or as being control of these things, right, be they difficulties or, you know, positivity, I think is central. And maybe that's what we need to be looking at more rather than just these platitudes about, you know, being happy or not.
No, indeed. And here's another one for you, right? Apparently, being a member of the clergy gives the greatest contentment. So if you're feeling a little bit down in the dumps, just go and join some kind of religious organization and become ordained.
There you go. Just say, you know what, this is the way things are meant to be. I need to them. I'm not sure about that, but there you go.
Although we did, I think we did a story last week about this, that people who have a religious belief tend to be happier in their sort of day-to-day lives. Partly,
yeah,
I assume.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised again, right? So it's this idea of meaning, right? So
yeah.
Evolutionary perspective, right? Since we evolved the ability to foresee our doom, right? Mm. It's a scary thing that this is going to end. So our lives, you know, there's people that argue that we need meaning. And it's interesting, in a more secular society, you see people becoming much more prone to believing in luck, right? So, you know, symbols like, you know, certain numbers or certain things become very, very big. They become much more superstitious. It's as if we need to believe there's something bigger out there. And if that is the case, then of course, having a religion would, you know, would satisfy that.
Indeed. And bizarrely, the fourth most contented profession, believe it or not, comes in as politicians. Now, they don't look very happy to me.
Certainly not these days. Yeah, well, there you go. I guess I wonder if there's something around, again, like on a more serious note, when you look at things, you know, like happiness, status is a very big one, right? So not necessarily in terms of am I genuinely happy, but this idea of feeling in control, feeling satisfaction. And I think it, the way that our politics are structured, that is that kind of, it denotes that status. So I wonder if that's part of it.
Yeah, I wonder if it is. So, I mean, do we have to wait, I mean, till we're 70 then to feel that this a sense of thrilling,
no,
you know, happiness and contentment?
No, I think, do you know what? I think you can train yourself to feel better. I think, number one, look for things every day. You know, happiness doesn't fall into your lap, so seek it out. Don't forget, our brains, again, from an evolutionary point of view, we're much more prone to seek out stuff that stresses us because that's how we protect ourselves, right? That's how we survived. We looked out for the berry that was going to poison us or for the wild animal that was going to hurt us. So when you walk around, you're going to be thinking about your problems today. Instead of doing that, look out for things that make you happy. It can be something small. You know, I caught the train. I didn't have to wait for it.
Yeah.
You know, my favorite lunch was on the menu. I spoke to a friend. Look out for these things. Note them. You know, you can train your brain to kind of seek out happiness. And also,
yeah, I've always thought there are happy people and unhappy people.
There are. And one of the good things to do is to... Research that I always quote, because sort of that looks at lottery winners, and it looks at people that have lost a limb, and they find that immediately, obviously, lottery winners are over the moon.
Yeah.
That have gone through accidents feel terrible. Within 6 months' time, they've both reached the baseline level of happiness or unhappiness that they were. So the lottery winners are going, well, my life's still a bit awful.
Yeah.
People now are hounding me for money. And the people that have had this accident have said, you know what, I've found a new lease of life because now I'm kind of, you know, being able to take up this sport that I never thought I'd do, or I'm like campaigning. So, you know, that kind of, you know, the idea that we can't choose to be happy. I understand there's biochemistry involved, there's a lot there, but you can't choose to shift it by looking at what you attend to. So take some responsibility for how, you know, you're curating, you know, the stuff that comes into your consciousness. What are you reading? Who are you hanging out with? What are you focusing on? And that will give you a boost, whatever age you are, no doubt.
Absolutely right. Dr. Linda Papadopoulos, brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. If you win the lottery, just hack off one of your limbs and then you'll see how lucky you feel.
More blasted rhetoric from the Banana Republic for people who think capital punishment isn't going nearly far enough.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham
on Talk Radio.
No milk today, my love has gone away. The bottle stands forlorn, a symbol of the dawn. No milk today, it seems a common sight, but people passing by don't know the reason why. How could they know?
0344 499 1000 is the number to call us on. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk about violent video games, because a report has just come out, and I'm not entirely surprised that it's just come out and said this, that actually violent video games don't make kids any more violent than they were before. However, what I would say is it might not make them violent, but it certainly can't be all that good for them if they're spending hours and hours and hours every single day playing them. But we'll have that debate coming up in the next hour. Coming up shortly, we're going to talk about milk and why so many pints of milk, millions of pints of milk, it has to be said, are on the missing list and do not get drunk and get thrown away because the sell-by date passes and people decide that it's not safe to drink it. Absolute and utter rubbish. First, though, let's talk to Vicky, who's called in from Brighton. Hello, Vicky.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the show. What would you like to say?
Well, I was so interested to hear that conversation you were having with the council employee, et cetera, about the bin collection and so on.
Yeah.
You know, the big elephant in the room, and this is never given much publicity, is that it's been estimated now, and this is a report going back to 2015 that I re-looked again, that 34 pence of every pound that all of us pay in council tax is required for council tax employee pensions.
Mm.
And it's simply the fact that when the private sector, absolutely across the board, really ditched what's called defined pensions, which means, you know, because they couldn't afford them. That was the point. And people in the private sector have had to pay more if they've got private pensions and so on and so forth. But of course, Gordon Brown never bit the bullet at the time. This is going back years. And so basically, you know, this is a lot of money. And I just wonder whether people realise it. I totally accept that there are people working for the council who are on low salaries, you know, and their pension would reflect that. But all I know is a lot of people working for the pension for the council are on very, very, very good salaries.
Yes. Well, you see, the thing about this, and you'll know this, Vicky, as well, is that the original idea of working in the public sector was that you would not be paid an awful lot of money, but you would get very good benefits and you would get good holidays, very good sick pay and decent pensions. However, now they've got the best of all worlds, haven't they?
Completely, completely. But as I say, it's always like, you know, they talk about their funding's been reduced by and all the rest of it, but nobody ever flags this up.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder how many people listening to know that 34 pence of every pound they pay to the council is required for pensions.
Yes. Well, I must admit, and you may not be surprised to know this, Vicky, but I've banged that particular drum for quite a few years. I may not have done it particularly recently, but I discovered this many years ago, and I've been repeating it ad nauseam to anyone that wants to listen. So I'm very glad that you're a fellow traveller on this, because it's true. They spend more money on pensions and wages than they do on anything else.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, and it really just makes me so cross when every other excuse is used for council finances, but everybody shuts up about this because so many of them are doing very nicely, thank you, when it comes to retiring.
Yeah.
I mean, blimey, I worked from the age of 16, University of Life and all that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the amount of money and national insurance and all the rest of it that I paid and scrimped and saved to get a pension fund together, you know, and the private, the public sector, as you say, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was seen as low pay but good benefits and pension and everything. But now the kind of salaries that people are earning working for the council at what I would call mid-management and above level is just astronomical.
Yeah.
Absolutely astronomical.
I know. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Vicky. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Sorry, I'm just cutting you short there slightly because we're running out of time. We're coming up to very nearly midday. We've got to speak to a very important man, Professor Martin Akaraha, Professor of Food and Health Policy, because he's going to tell us why it is that 80 million pints of supermarket milk are wasted every year because use-by dates are up to 7 days too strict. Professor, very good morning to you.
Morning. Hello.
Now, the first question I'm going to ask you is, do you drink milk that has gone past its sell-by date?
Yeah.
So do I. Congratulations and welcome to the world of common sense. But why do they do it so ridiculously? I mean, I go into a supermarket sometimes and just to be awkward and mention something else. Lettuce, always has the same day on it that you're buying it. So when you buy it, it's already out of date.
Yeah, but one of the problems here is people are overcautious and the supermarkets are overcautious because they're afraid people will come back and sue them and say, I got sick from your product.
Yeah.
What we've lost is an element of common sense.
Right.
You just need to look at products, you need to sniff it.
Right.
You know, whether I'd serve milk like that to, if I had people around for dinner, I'm not completely sure. You know, I would take the risk myself, but...
Yeah. Well, we've all had that embarrassing moment where you pour the milk into the tea in front of the person you're giving it to, and it all starts to curdle, and you go,
out of the bottle. I mean, that's the other thing.
But I mean, really, have we lost all sense of proportion in this country?
Well, we've lost some sense, but it's also that if you think about the cheapness of milk, you know, that we know that farmers aren't getting paid. Farmers are getting paid below the gate price.
Yeah.
So they're actually so and milk is one of the things that's a loss leader when they go into the supermarket.
Yeah.
The supermarkets deliberately keep milk low so that you buy it and you think, oh, I'll just buy some because I've had that.
And they do sell it now in ever-increasing kind of containers, don't they? I mean, I don't really feel the need, even if I'm buying milk for the family fridge with two kids and their mother, I don't feel the need to have a sort of four-pint container of milk in the fridge.
Well, with kids, maybe you do. I mean, I can see the point. You know, I just had my grandkids over for the weekend. We were running out of milk suddenly, where the two of us don't normally run out of milk, but the kids were drinking it. You know, we were like, oh, my gosh, we need to go and get another, you know, litre of milk.
Yeah.
I do see why better milk than some other, you know, soft drinks or something. But it's also we've lost the ability to think about what we might do with that milk.
Mm.
You know, even if you're a bit dubious, people don't make their own bread anymore. People don't turn it into other things. People just chuck it down the drain.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And, of course, it's so cheap. There's no incentive to keep it and use it in other ways. You just chuck it down the drain.
But we're talking here, apparently, about 20 billion quid's worth of wasted food. That's an incredible amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, the average family in the UK, on average, it wastes, i.e. in the front door, out the back door, £600 a year.
Wow. That's mad, isn't it?
It's mad, you know.
I mean, could we not? Maybe we're attacking it in the wrong way, because perhaps instead of having the conversation you and I are having about it's ridiculous, show more common sense, we should maybe be trying to tell people that they're wasting their own money, because maybe that would have more resonance with them.
I think so. I mean, I think it might. I mean, saying, actually, do you realise? And also providing them with options. You know, what do you do with milk that's gone slightly off? Well, you can make bread with it. You can do other things with it. I mean, people have a lot. There is a loss of skills, I think, generally among the population.
Yeah.
And a loss of confidence in food. People,
do you know what I would do? I've come up with a brilliant idea, and I'd like you to tell me what you think. Have somebody standing at the end of the supermarket, right? And as you're walking out the door with your trolley, they make you give them something back. One thing out of what you bought.
No, that's very interesting.
Isn't that
be one way of doing it.
And I think really that could work. And then you could give that to a food bank at the same time or something.
Yeah, well, you could ask them, what do you need? What are you buying that you really haven't got any plans
for
in your basket? And say, why don't you put that back and or donate it somewhere else? That
and if they've got like two-litre containers of milk, make them give one of them back.
Yeah, well, that might be, you know, that's what home economists used to do.
Yeah.
Maybe we just need to have a home economist in each supermarket.
Yeah, I mean, it is, I mean, incredibly, in my lifetime, and I suspect you're not much older than me, in my lifetime, the whole supermarket thing has gone kind of nuclear. You know, I mean, I remember going into the first supermarket I went to with my mother back in the 60s, which was on Finchley Road. I think it was a Sainsbury's. And it was about roughly the size of what we now would call one of those metro stores, you know?
Yeah.
And that was as big as it needed to be. Now, it's ridiculous.
Well, that's why the hard discounters, Aldi and Lidl, have filled a slot in the market.
Yeah.
People have got overwhelmed with the big supermarkets, and they're looking for less choice. So particularly during the recession, when we all noticed food prices going up, we started reevaluating our shopping. And actually, the big supermarkets are themselves moving this way, because people have moved from monthly shops to weekly shops.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you only do a monthly shop, you tend to buy too much stuff, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, because you don't know what you're going to be doing at the end, so you put stuff in your basket thinking, I might use that. I mean, when food prices went up between 2007 and 2012, we were, even if you could afford it, you were aware of the increase in food prices.
Right.
And people have changed their shopping habits. So, I mean, but still, it's £600 in the front door, out the back door. That's that's a holiday.
It is. The other way you could do it is by giving people a muffin every time they walk into a supermarket, right? Because
give them an apple. Give them something healthy.
What's wrong with a muffin? It could be a blueberry muffin.
Occasionally, but as long as I've got coffee with it, I don't mind.
No, listen, you need to fill them up, because if they're shopping hungry, they're buying loads of food they don't need.
True.
So muffin on the way in, take something off them on the way out. There you go.
Well,
join my crusade.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1 Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.